You are listening to The Realish Report. Here's your host, John Friend.
Okay, guys, welcome back to another edition of The Realish Report. I am your host, John Friend. I'd like to thank everyone who has signed up for a lifetime subscription at therealishreport.com. And I'd also like to encourage everyone out there to consider becoming a lifetime subscriber, especially if you appreciate and support the work we are doing here. All right, with that said, joining me today is the courageous activist and budding Holocaust revisionist, Jim Rizzoli. Jim and I met for the first time at the Jim Traficant Memorial Tribute, organized by Pete Papaheracles of American Free Press, in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of November. Jim, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yes, yeah, it's really an honor to have you here. You know, I've been a big fan of your work for, gosh, a few years now, so it was definitely a pleasure to meet you out in D.C., and then, you know, I'm glad that we could follow up and have this discussion. I actually appeared as a guest on your, you do a video interview type channel on YouTube.
Yeah, that's just all the things. When I do my videos, if I can interview someone with Skype, I try to do that as much as I can.
And, right.
So you were one of the ones I've, other than the other people in the league that I've been interviewing, you were one of the others.
Yes, quite an honor. Yeah, and we'll talk about the League of Extraordinary Revisionists, your new project, and a number of other subjects as we, you know, as we go through this discussion today. But sure. First, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, talk about your background, your education, you know, maybe where you grew up, and any details of your professional life that you're comfortable sharing?
Sure. Well, I am not some big scholar here, but I'm just an ordinary person. In regards to myself, I had my own business. I ran a service business, service-related business, for many years, and I'm retired. But that retirement was precipitated by things that have gone on in my town, so it was kind of like a forced retirement in some ways, but then I had some health issues I had to deal with too. But other than that, I'm retired now. My background in regards to history, I'm a history buff, always been, so that's been on the back burner with me for many years. Since I got on the internet, I've been a researcher, so I consider myself a semi-historian researcher on all types of things. And now I have a lot of time to do more with it. So that's pretty much it, you know, my background there. Nothing fancy, no schmancy, you know, things I can speak of about all these degrees or this or that. Just an ordinary guy, fed up with what I see going on in the world. And, you know, pretty much I didn't keep things to myself. I basically got into ways to enunciate my views in life. And that has been through... I don't know if you want me to talk about my video stuff, but
yeah, I was gonna ask you about that. But first, I'm curious. Well, one thing that's interesting is we really do have the ability now with the internet and with modern technology to learn about all these subjects. People that, you know, aren't necessarily educated at a prestigious university or, you know, whatever. Everyone really has the ability to find out the truth of some of the most controversial and important events in history, including this fake Jewish Holocaust story. And that's exactly what guys like you have done. That's what guys like I have done, although I did actually go to college and get a degree. But I mean, really, with the internet, we have the ability to access so much information and really get down to the truth and figure out what's really going on in this world.
Right. Yeah, it's been great for me. I mean, I don't know what I would have done without the internet. I mean, the message would have been you know, not as broad and reach so many people, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, now, how did you first get into revisionism?
That's an interesting story. What happened with me, it actually started with illegal immigration.
Right.
And
I see that on your website.
Yeah, so what happened was I was looking into some stuff about illegal immigration, and particularly in my town, what happens is people... deportations of people in my town were not happening much. But then all of a sudden, I run into a deportation, more or less, of a man named Ernst Zundel back in, I don't know when it was, 2002 or something.
Which time? I mean, the man was deported like, what, three or
four
times?
Well, he came to the United States. He settled down, got married. So when he was living in the United States, which was around, what, 2002-ish?
I think it was like early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so what happened with him, that really got my attention, because I'm saying, how the hell does a guy get deported to Canada from the United States on immigration issues? He's a white guy. Mm. And it's like, this doesn't make sense. And so I started looking in to find out what the heck he was about. And then, you know, I find out the Holocaust stuff. Even though I did have an interest in the Holocaust before that, this really, piqued my interest. So then I started reading about Ernest Zundel, his website, and the Holocaust, and I started getting into his videos.
Wow.
And it just went from there. So the immigration issue, more or less, was still big, but not as big as or interesting as the Holocaust issue.
Yeah, and Ernst Zundel's story is a good way to wake people up to this subject. There's some great documentaries that they put together, one of which was titled Germany Off Your Knees. I believe that was the title of the documentary, and it kind of went through and showed Ernst Zundel's struggle in Canada and the information he was exposing and all the trials. Right. And, you know, I mean, it's such a huge topic, and it's really amazing what the man was able to do.
Yeah.
And truly outrageous what happened to him, how he was persecuted and, as you said, deported, and he was jailed in Germany for a number of years. It's just incredible. And from what I understand, he's still, you know, basically, can he, I don't even know if he can leave Germany, although I do know he went to a conference in Mexico.
Well, he can go to Mexico, but he can't come to the United States,
can he?
Yeah, well, I heard he was banned for like 20 years or something.
That is just outrageous. I mean, this is a man who has never hurt anybody in his life. He's never committed any sort of crime aside from, you know, critically thinking about the fake Holocaust story and exposing relevant information.
Right. He's a pacifist.
He's a pacifist. He's had his house torched by Jewish terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, you can find a lot of these videos on YouTube. You actually posted a video on your YouTube channel called El Gran Taboo.
Yes.
And it kind of talks about a number of important revisionists, many of whom you've actually interviewed recently.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, these are important videos that, you know, if anybody just sits down and watches them, I mean, they have to be intrigued and more than likely outraged at what some of these men have gone through.
Right, right. And I just want to bring up a point about Zundel.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Holocaust issue, you know, that got him in the trouble, you know. That was just part of it. The real issue with him, you know, was 9/11.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He was talking about 9/11 before he was talking about the Holocaust?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had a whole thing on 9/11 when he was doing his videos and his shows, and he was exposing it really well at that time. And that was the thing they were getting him on, his like terrorism type of stuff. You see what
I see. You mean to justify his being deported from the United States?
Yeah. As far as I understand it. Now, I'm not saying the Holocaust issue wasn't a big, the real reason, I mean, in regards to, you know, the Jews' reason to influence people, but he just was touching on the whole, I mean, on the 9/11 issue more than they wanted at that time.
I see, yeah. Well, that certainly does not surprise me, although I didn't know that, so that's a very interesting tidbit of history.
Right.
You know, I wanted to ask you, because this is something that's actually come up for me in my personal life recently, talking about these subjects and trying to explain the concept of revisionism, of historical revisionism. How would you, you know, tell, you know, just your average person on the street about revisionism? What is revisionism?
Well, basically, revisionism, you know, as a group, or probably a lot of people anyway, that have a viewpoint that what happened during World War II and the way they present it, the official Jewish version of it, is not what happened. Okay, so basically you're revising history. I mean, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so we basically feel that the official Jewish version is completely 100% wrong. I mean, it's not even close to being right. So, basically there's three aspects of the Holocaust that are really just out to lunch here. All right, in regards to, first of all, did Hitler have a policy to eliminate the Jews? No, there was no policy. Okay, first, was there 6 million of them killed? No, there wasn't even close to 6 million even being around in that area at the time, mm-hmm. and were they killed in homicidal gas chambers? Those are the three main issues that revisionists have with the Holocaust. And so that's all you have to do is take apart each one of those, which are very easy to do, mm-hmm. all right? And you show them that, again, he didn't have a plan. You know, there were no homicidal gas chambers. There were no 6 million. Use all their own information. Mm-hmm. And it just hit. That's it. That's the only thing the Holocaust stands on.
Well, and those really are the three main tenets of the fake Holocaust story. And, yeah, we can easily demonstrate that all three of those tenets are absolutely false on, you know, in virtually every regard. But this idea of revisionism, I mean, from what I understand, it really actually goes back to World War I.
Yeah.
There was a man named Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes, who the Barnes Review mm-hmm. History magazine, which you guys should probably be subscribing to. Not you, but I'm saying that the, you know, everybody listening.
It's
a great publication, yeah. Yeah. The magazine's named after Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes, and he was taking a second look at World War I and going through and debunking, how it was all the Germans' fault, because that was basically the official narrative after World War I, was these evil Germans started this war and they have to pay for it, and, you know, we have to oppress them forever because they want to take over the world. And that's sort of translated and perpetuated into World War II. A lot of the myths about Germany and Germans and, you know, these war atrocities and these alleged war crimes that were being leveled against the Germans in World War I were taking place in World War II on a whole other level. Right. And, of course, it became institutionalized with the fake Holocaust story at Nuremberg and in our culture and in our media and obviously in our educational system. So revisionism really goes back even before World War II, and it's all about bringing history into accord with the facts.
Right.
And that's a direct quote from Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes. And one thing that I've noticed is, you know, just since I've, you know, became aware of these issues and in revisionism itself, it's very clear that revisionists are very objective and skeptical and serious students of history. And their only agenda is getting to the truth.
Right.
Versus the mainstream historians, they clearly have an agenda. They very rarely ever want to engage in any sort of dialogue or debate about these issues because, frankly, we will crush and we will dominate because we have the facts on our side.
Right. Well, the thing with them, too, the historians, the reason why, like, people will say to me, well, how come there's not more written on the subject matter people backing you up? Well, it's very simple. Anybody that's a historian in academia who's getting paid, he's not going to have a job. I mean,
yes.
It's simple. So they have to write that, you know, what they write has to be in harmony with whoever they work for. And if those people they work for agree with it, fine. If they don't, they don't have a job. So who's going to write books? Who's going to, in an institution or some school or whatever, who's going to write on the topic if it's going to get you fired?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, a mainstream historian is certainly not going to be dealing with these subjects. Even if they have tenure and they're immune from being fired, they're still not going to do it. But the thing that amazes me is we actually have tons of very scholarly, very mm-hmm. academic, very thorough studies into the Holocaust, into virtually every single aspect of the Holocaust, gas chambers, the camps in the East. I mean, you name it, the alleged victims and the alleged survivors. There's been so much research done. Much of it is available, again, from the Barnes Review. You can purchase pretty much any of these books dealing critically with these subjects by very serious, very intelligent, and very scientific people. I mean, these aren't like amateurs out there conducting these investigations. These are professionals.
Right.
And there's maybe you can name some of the names, but it's not as if, you know, we haven't done the research. We have thoroughly and scientifically debunked every single aspect of this story. It's just a matter of us getting our information out there. Could you maybe talk about, sort of the history of revisionism and some of the key figures and what they've discovered?
Well, who we have here, like I have, first of all, I have all the Holocaust handbooks.
From the Barnes Review, yeah.
Yeah, I have the whole set, except I'm missing number 10, 11, and 12. That's the only ones I'm missing.
Okay.
But anyway, the original, I have the older books too, some of the older books dealing with revisionism, and the oldest, it goes way back to Paul Rosner. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, Rosner. But anyway, he was one of the first ones to write about the camps because he was a prisoner in
he was a French POW, correct?
Yes, he was. Yeah, yeah, he was in Buch, I believe it was Buchenwald and Dora, which that's where they I think Dora was where they were working on the missiles. They were the laborers were working on the missiles for Germany. Well, anyway, so you know, he basically, long story short, he gets out, and all of a sudden he's hearing all these stories about the horrors of the Holocaust, and about even where he was, and he's saying, "What the heck's going on here? I didn't experience any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
None of that stuff happened." And so, if you get into his books, The Genocide Myth, he wrote that book, and he has some other ones too, you know, supplements to it. But he was the first one to really, expose the Holocaust, the hoax, for what it was, showing
right.
you that a lot of the things that they're saying is not true. So this was, you know, it was in the 60s and 70s, you know, and all that. So he was the first one that really get things going.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Faurisson, you know.
Right, another Frenchman, yeah.
Another Frenchman, and basically he, you know, he read Rosner's stuff, and he, you know, obviously thought it was true too. So he became an individual who started looking into it deeply, writing a lot about it. And of course, when he wrote about it in the 70s, you know, he got persecuted for it. You know what I'm saying?
Of course, yeah.
You know, they came after him like gangbusters.
And he was even violently attacked and assaulted on multiple occasions as well.
Right.
And this man was a very important scholar in France. I mean, wasn't he a professor of?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was a professor of, what was it? Was it language or literature?
Yes. Yes, I believe it was language. So
yeah, he was like an expert in French and in I'm assuming other European languages. I'm not exactly sure.
Right. Right.
But
yes.
Yeah, he was a very scholarly, you know.
Oh, sure.
Intelligent
man.
Look
what happened to him.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know I think he lost his job, if I can recall. But anyway, they wanted to kill him. I mean,
literally kill him. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was obviously one of the main persons, you know, other than Rosner, you know, after him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, then you have Germar Rudolf, who probably out of all of them, I really put Germar at the top because he's probably done the most writing,
right?
In the most information he's printed or edited. In other words, people will come to him with stuff, and he'll edit it and get it all ready to publish and stuff. So, you know, Germar Rudolf, being a young guy, he probably is. After Faurisson, the next guy on the list, on the top. There's
yes.
No doubt about it.
Now, and yeah. he was a young PhD student in chemistry at the
right.
Max Planck Institute in Germany,
right.
a very prestigious university.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And from what I understand, he basically did an analysis at the alleged gas chambers in Auschwitz. And correct me if I'm wrong. And he had this whole report prepared, which basically debunked the whole gas chamber myth.
Right.
And someone who he thought he could trust had access to it and actually released it. He didn't even publish it. You know, he didn't make it public. Somebody did it, you know, sort of behind his back. And he was, you know, almost immediately fired and kicked out of school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he was even prosecuted eventually at one point. He was spent some time in jail. So
yeah.
It's just amazing what some of these guys have gone through just for engaging
right.
in critical scientific study.
Right. Yeah. He went to jail for, I think, a couple years, I believe he was in jail. And they still come after him. Or they you know, he had to move to England. I mean, that's what he had to do. And if he went back to Germany today, he'd be arrested again. I think he'd go
think
back
so.
To jail.
Well, now, and also, didn't he, yeah, he went to England, but didn't he also get essentially kicked out of England too? They declared him persona non grata?
I can't remember that.
I think they did. I think even
yeah, he
went to Spain originally and then Spain
well, he
was
went,
cracking
he went,
down.
Yeah, he went to a couple countries, yeah. And
yeah.
He, but, you know, the thing is, he ended up in the United States. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, he's here now, and you know, he's actually running the CODO site.
Right.
So
he's still involved and doing good work. I've heard him on. I hear him on Dr. David Duke's radio program every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Know, he's
good.
He's
yeah.
phenomenal. Yeah, he's like out of all the revisionists, I mean, they're all good in their own ways, but he's probably done the most writing, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, and he published the book, I have it, Dissecting the Holocaust,
yeah,
which
yeah,
is just, I mean, you know, yeah, one of the most scholarly and
oh, yeah,
you know, thorough dealings with the fake Holocaust story that is out there.
Yeah, I'm reading that now, actually. It's a big, I got the big version of it.
Yeah, and I can't even, I'm not even going to attempt to claim I've read the whole thing, because I most certainly haven't. It's a huge book. I've read some of it. I mean, some of the chapters, and many of the chapters, I mean, each chapter really deals with a different aspect of the Holocaust.
Right.
So it's very,
right,
it's very thorough,
right,
very thorough. And it is a complex subject. But I think, as you mentioned, if you boil it down to the three main tenets, what is the Holocaust? What is the official narrative? You know, the 6 million, the gas chambers, and then the systematic policy to murder Jewry. None of those stand up to scrutiny at all.
Right.
So it's very easy to kind of, you know, deal with this subject, you know, in its basics. But of course, there's so many details that,
right,
you know, it's important guys like Guillermo Rudolph and others, you know, actually, yeah, dig into and get to the bottom of. Now, another thing that you know, when we're talking about revisionism, one thing that, you know, a lot of people just don't even stop to think about is the victors always write the history books, right? So you're always getting a biased perspective of history or really anything. And that's just something that we never, you know, not we, but, you know, a lot of people never even stop to think about.
Right.
So,
well, I don't even waste my time reading this stuff anymore, because it's so bad.
Yeah.
All right. It's so bad. You're sitting down saying, how could they ever come up with these conclusions without researching this out? They're just taking people's, you know, these witnesses, all these, you know, so-called witness testimony, which is completely lies, and they're presenting it to the public like it happened. And it just makes me sick. And I mean, the only books worth reading that are going to give you both sides of the story are the revisionist books. Or the, you know, videos, whatever they have. Nothing else out there. I mean, there's all these guys writing about the Holocaust from the Jewish perspective. It's just so badly researched. And even the historians that have written their big books, like Raul Hilberg, you know, and all these type of guys, Van Pelt and all these guys, this stuff is just so bad.
It's terrible, yeah. Well, and revisionists have systematically gone through and refuted every single one of these arguments in great,
sure,
detail.
Right.
That's the amazing thing. It's like we have just dominated this debate the entire time. And
right,
it's really just a matter of Jewish control of the media and of Hollywood. That's really what it all boils down to.
Right, right.
Because,
oh, yeah,
I mean, we have the facts on our side. It's just,
yeah,
we've been prevented from getting them out in a big-time way. However, I think that's changing. I mean, I think there's more people aware of Holocaust revisionism than maybe at any other time in history.
Yeah, no, people are finally coming to grips with it. But, again, the reason why it hasn't become mainstream is because of the fact is, if you show your face to it, you're going to have a problem with your job, and you could be fired. You know, I'm just telling you, that's what's going to happen to you. There's just no way out of it.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's what happened to me.
Yep, exactly. I was going to say, it's happened to so many people. It happened to me recently. I mean, that was a contributing factor.
Sure.
Was just my views in general, but I mean, specifically relating to the Holocaust,
yeah,
and Hitler and World War II. And you know, in my experience, I mean, that is the most, it is the grand taboo, as that documentary we discussed earlier, you know, that nails it. It really is the most taboo subject in our society. I think maybe race would be, you know, second or maybe even tied, but they're both so fundamentally tied together.
Right. Yeah.
And this
you
was
don't go
actually
to jail, though. You don't go to jail for talking about race.
That's
you
true.
Go to,
good point.
You go to jail,
yes,
for talking about the Holocaust is the only topic in the whole world that you go to jail for not believing the official story in 18 countries.
Yes.
Okay? So,
it's,
I mean, there's nothing in life that comes close to having that happen. Nothing.
You know, and it's interesting, too, when people find out that, like, I don't believe the Holocaust is real, they, you know, and 9 times out of 10, they're like, wow, really? You actually believe that? Like, they can't even fathom the possibility that the Holocaust could be a deception in any way. And right. I think the main reason why is because it's so pervasive in our society. It really is, you know, drilled into us as kids. And we see it in movies. We see our government officials talk about it. We see these alleged Holocaust survivors talk about it. And it's just everywhere. And it's a very traumatizing, very exploitative horror story that is totally fictional, but it's been, people have been led to believe that it's actually real because of propaganda and because of our, you know, our educational establishment promoting it.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, I mean, think about it, okay? You do a Google search if you do Google Alerts, okay? You know, you get on Google, you do Google Alerts, and you put Holocaust in there. And you're going to see it either every day or every other day. You're going to get 5 to 10 hits on somewhere in the world that the Holocaust topic is coming up on the internet or in the news.
Absolutely.
And then you're going to see. I mean, this is not a small thing. They have actually infiltrated every aspect of our society with all their people. Like, for instance, the Holocaust survivors, they have them all on speaking tours. I mean, this is what they do. They put these people in towns, or they find people who are Holocaust survivors, whatever that means, and they get them to go out and go to the schools. I mean, mm-hmm. systematically.
I've seen it firsthand, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, how can you not be inundated with this crap when it's in your face? I mean, you don't mind, but it's in your face every day,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's what bothers me.
Oh yeah, I agree, and it's something that I mean I write quite a bit about it on my website. I have a section called News from the Jews, where I just, you know, kind of highlight news articles appearing in the Jewish press, appearing in the Jewish Daily Forward and the Times of Israel, Jewish Telegraph Agency. I mean, you name it. And you know, not every single time I post one of those blog posts on my site, not every time it's dealing with the Holocaust, but in many cases it is, because it always comes up every single day. I'm reading articles about the fake Holocaust story, about some new memoir that's been released from some Holocaust survivor and their miraculous tale of escaping the Nazis and, you know, living this heroic life. And, you know, it's just one fantastical story after another with these people, and they just keep on doing it. They will never give this fake story and their entire racket they've created out of it. They will never give this up, ever.
Oh no, it's a great, you know, some of them get paid for it, I'm sure, or whatever. But it's a racket. I mean, it's a racket. They have all the bases covered to get this in the news all the time. And again, the poor old Jews are the victims, no matter what.
Exactly. There was two or three Holocaust-related films that are up for Academy Awards this year.
Sure, yeah.
I just wrote about it, and I mean, literally every single year. Let me find the article real quick. I titled it "More Holocaust Propaganda at the Oscars."
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, here it is. It's
Son of Saul is one.
Yeah, and I mean, these are really just. Two Holocaust-themed films make the Oscar cut. Son of Saul and Labyrinth of Lies.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there you have it, guys. I mean, every single day, all day, every day,
right?
You know, at the most elite levels of society, including at the Oscars, you know, we got the Holocaust, more Holocaust propaganda.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. I'm kind of going on a rant about this because it's just, I mean, it really just makes me mad. You know, it's just outrageous what's going on. Let's talk about the League of Extraordinary Revisionists. When did you set this organization up, and who was involved?
Sure. I met Diane, who has been very helpful to me. In fact, she's the one that's the main person here, if you ask me. Okay.
Lovely lady. Hello, Diane.
Yeah. Diane is from Texas, and she just so happened to stumble upon me on the internet on Facebook. And she called me because she had the same views I did. And, you know, we actually got together. She actually came up here. She actually is here now. And so she was the one that actually had all the names of all these people that I've wanted to get in touch with. I didn't know, you know, where these people were. She finds out that Fred Luchter lives a couple, you know, he probably lives about 20 miles away from me.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. I didn't even know that. I thought he was in California. So she, you know, she did all her research, and basically she got in touch with Fred, and then, you know, her and Fred, and then me, we're basically, you know, Fred said, why don't we get other people right to the interview? Because I wanted to interview Fred in the beginning, but, you know, I didn't really know him. And he's probably, you know, kind of suspicious of who I am. And so, you know, we ended up going out to eat with him a couple times just to break the, you know, break the water here, just to make it nice and comfortable. And he finally accepted me. And then I said, well, let's, what do you say? I like to interview you, Fred. I mean, you haven't been, no one's talked to you in 20 years. And
yeah.
So he was my first interview, but he's the one that thought it up, basically. Him and Diane were behind it. And they, you know, they had all the ties, they had all the people to contact, and they, you know, got it all together. And then we decided to call it the League of Extraordinary Revisionists. And, you know, it just went from there. And basically within, let's see, that started in September. He was my first interview in September. And then in October, I believe I did Farison.
Yep.
September? No, okay. So I did Farison.
Farison was in October. Yep. I'm looking at the YouTube channel. And then then it looks like you had both Frederick Tobin and Guillermo Rudolph on in November.
Yes, and then I just finished up with Bradley. I'm working on Ernst Zundel, but I don't know how that's going to happen. But we'll see what I can do. I'd like to get him in there. And those would be probably the big six. Oh, Lady Michelle Renault, she's in England.
Yeah,
we're working on her too. So, you know, basically that's what I'm doing now. Okay, Diane and I are just basically trying to get these interviews going, trying to get the other side of the story. From people who witnessed it, who went through it, who wrote about it, you know, the big, the heavy hitters. And, you know, I'm just going from there, you know.
You know what is such a travesty? I really wish we would have been able to interview Willis Carter before he passed.
Right. Well, yeah, that was one of – actually, us coming down here, we were supposed to interview Willis.
In D.C.?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That was a big reason why I was going out there was to meet Willis, and he passes away like literally 2 days before I leave.
Yeah, I know. So he was going to be –
I was really sad about that.
Yeah, he was going to be in our interview stream because that same week I interviewed Gurma too coming down to Washington. So
okay.
You know, so you know, I was going to do two interviews. I might as well, you know, get both of them done because I'm out on the road. You know, so I got, you know, I would have got Willis done, but anyway, he passed away, so that was the end of that.
Yeah, so. God bless him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's cool. So you guys were just really trying to interview some of the big time revisionists. Do you have anybody else in mind? I mean, you had mentioned Zundel, but is there anybody else that?
Well, like I said, Lady Michelle Renouf, she's going to be the next one too.
Okay, yeah.
I'm gonna interview other people too that I've written on the subject matter, like Benton Bradbury.
Yeah, he'd be a good guest. Yeah,
yeah, we're going to interview him in January, I believe, and because he wrote the book, The Auschwitz Myth. No, the Myth of German Villainy.
Yeah,
The Myth of German Villainy, and that has to be one of the best books. If you read any book, I'm telling you right now, if you read any book, that's the book you want to read first. Because that's going to give you all the information from the 1850s all the way up until now about Germany, World War I, World War II, how it all happened, and of course the Holocaust and all that. So that's a really, really good book for people to start.
Yes, yes. And you know what is terrible? I have that book, and I have not read. I need to sit down and read that. Like,
well, I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I know it's good.
You'll love it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you have any interest in interviewing a guy like maybe Tom Goodrich, who wrote Hellstorm, which documented the real Holocaust that took place during World War II?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could interview him, but see, the problem is I'm interviewing people who haven't been out there. And
okay.
Goodrich, is, I mean, you know, he's out there quite a bit on a lot of – I've heard him several times.
Right.
But I don't have no problem doing that, but I thought, you know, that I'd get all the main people involved with it. You know, first, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Now, how about any of the European revisionists, Carlo Montonio?
Well, he's Italian, so I wouldn't be able to talk to him. Yeah, he doesn't speak English at all.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We've tried to get in touch with some other people out in Europe, but I guess some of them German people, but that hasn't happened. We plan on going at some point to Toronto to interview the German people. Survive is in Toronto.
There's, okay.
I guess
is there a pretty big community out there?
There's a community of them, right, or something? Yes, yes. So that's in our plans to do that, to get their side of the story. So we'll see how that goes. So, I mean, you know, we're trying to just get the message out, you know.
Now, what's the purpose of all this, of doing these interviews?
Well, you want to have a record of it. That's all. I mean, these people are going to, you know, Farrison's old. I mean, he's not going to, how long is he going to live? You know, Bradley Smith, his health is horrible.
Is it? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Bradley's got, cancer of the blood.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so he's not well. And, you know, Grandma, of course, is young, so that's no problem there. Ernst Zundel, I mean, I hope I can interview him because he's in his 70s? He's going to be 75 years old, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, so we just thought that if we could get these things done, that would be good, you know.
And yeah, it's a great project. I love it.
Well, no, it's fun. What we're trying to do, next project we're trying to do too, is I'm trying to hook up with these colleges up here to see if we can, if I can anyway, or Girma with me or whatever, go in and talk to them, the college people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I need to try to do that too out here. That's what I should be doing.
Well, I'm just saying, yeah, that's what you should be doing. You should be trying to hook up with that project, like Bradley Smith tried to do that back in the 80s.
Yeah, he was successful. He actually got on a couple campuses.
Sure, yeah, he did. Yeah. But I think that a young guy like you would probably have better luck doing it, and that would be great if you can do that. I mean, you should really try.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe that's something. Well, it's obviously something I should be doing. I'll get on
right.
it.
Right. Well, no, I'm just saying. Okay. You know, if you need me to come out with you and help you out, I'd be happy to do it.
You and Diane can come out and we can. Right. We'll do a little speaking to her. That'd be fun. Let's
well,
do
I'm,
it.
Well, I'm just saying, if that's what we're looking to do. See,
I want
somebody, especially in Massachusetts, in Boston, we have the most colleges of any place in the area. I mean,
gosh,
the whole world.
That's true. Yeah, you guys do have a lot of universities out there.
If we could, I talked to Grandma about it. I said I'd love to really get set up to go into these places and see what we can do, because you know it's not that far away for me to go to do it. So anyway, that's another thing we're hoping to do. So
yeah, sure. Let's we'll have to talk more about that, and maybe this coming 2016 we'll really get on that. So okay, I wanted to move on and talk more about the fake Holocaust story, obviously, and I'd like for you to lay out the best arguments against this truly weaponized narrative of history.
Well, basically, the simplest thing is you have to. There's so many facets to it because there's so many camps that people can bring you into and this and that. I deal with Auschwitz.
Okay.
Auschwitz is the main camp. Auschwitz one. All right. And that's the camp that they show people. If you're going to go on a tour of Auschwitz, that's the camp you're going to see. All right. And of course, they've changed the tour. They don't show you everything on the tour anymore. But anyway, the first building there that you're going to see in Auschwitz is Crema 1. That's where, you know, they claim now in the beginning, I'm talking way in the beginning, that 4 million people went through that building. I mean, this is what I heard when I used to get into the Holocaust narrative. Of course, I don't even see that video anymore. I think it's been taken down, the girl talking about that. But anyway, the deaths, you know, they say 4 million were killed in Auschwitz now, remember, and the 6 million was adding all the other camps. But the 4 million figure back in 1989, 1990, they lowered that figure because the revisionists obviously were exposing how ridiculous it was. They lowered the figure to 1 million, and that's actually been lowered even more by some people writing their books. They've actually lowered the figure down even to 500,000 or whatever. But anyway, so Auschwitz 1, Crema 1, that's the building that they say was the place where people were executed. And when you look at that building, that's all you have to do is just look at it. You see that it's a bomb shelter. And before that, it was a morgue. And before that, it was a hospital. I mean, there was a lot of functions for that building. But the biggest thing is it was never used as a homicidal gas chamber because it's not set up to be that. And David Cole has an excellent tour of that facility, if you want to look up David Cole's video back in the 90s, You did a video on that. So you can look at that 96 or something like that. I don't know.
Well, and in that video, doesn't he basically prove, and the people that work at this museum, which, by the way, guys, millions of people pay money to visit every year you know, become brainwashed and indoctrinated. But in that video, doesn't he basically prove that the alleged gas chamber was basically a reconstruction, like a propaganda prop, basically, set up by the Soviets? Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So they're literally creating these fake gas chambers. I mean, that's what it is.
Right, but people have to understand this, and they don't understand this, that at the end of the war, the Americans didn't get into Auschwitz until 10 years later.
Right.
10 years. So the Soviets were the ones that got into Auschwitz and liberated the camp. Now, they had 10 years to do whatever they wanted in these camps. And what they did is they just made a Disneyland out of them, a horror Disneyland on the Holocaust. That's basically what
they did. No, they really did. That is a good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I mean,
so they took the building and, you know, you have to understand the whole concept of how they claim people died. And when you understand this, it makes no sense at all.
It really is just absurd what they say. Yeah.
Yeah. So they, you know, here's a building, you know, it had no holes in the roof, and then they chopped 4 holes in the roof, and they said they threw in these pellets of Zyklon B. But you have to understand, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You know, think about it. You have a room that you might be able to hold, you know, 200 to 300 people packed in. That's how big the room is. It's only like 800 square feet, 1,000 square feet or whatever it is. Not even a big room.
Yeah.
Okay? So now let's say you have, you know, 500 people in the room all squished together, and they're throwing in these Zyklon B pellets. Well, the pellets have to have room to work, and you have to blow air on them to get the gas to release from the pellets. Plus, it has to be a certain temperature. It has to be around 78 degrees, 80 degrees in the chamber to have this, happen. Okay? So if you're packed in with all these people, first of all, how are you going to get the air surrounding the pellets to get the air to disperse? It's not going to happen. Of course, the temperature in there is going to be warm. You're going to have 800 people, probably hundreds of people in there. I have no problem with that. But again, Zyklon B has to be able to work with air. It has to have warm air circulating it, and you need about 9 square feet per person to really have that air circulate around them. So 9 square feet in an 800 square foot room, I mean, you can only put 100 people in it. And they're saying they're squeezing in, you know, 500, 700, I don't know, 1,000 people into these rooms.
Logistically, it's not even possible, right?
No, yeah. it's not even, I mean, you can't even comprehend how stupid it is.
Yeah.
I mean, and think about it. Let's say someone's pouring these Zyklon B tablets on the ground and you're bouncing off your head and everything. I mean, you're not going to be just standing there. You're going to be pushing them away, aren't you? You know, push them into the corner or whatever, getting them out of the way. Of course, you know, that room they show you had no door on it separating it from the crematoria. So how the heck is this going to happen? You know, Zyklon B is highly explosive. And they say the crematoria is just like about 20 feet away in the next room with no door. I mean, you need, you know, those crematoria get up to, you know, pretty high temperatures if you're going to cremate a body. I mean, you have a lot of heat there. And I mean, come on. I mean, you have, two rooms here. And the room that they're killing these people supposedly in have a wooden door in it. It's got a window on the door. I mean, you know, wouldn't you just break the door down? I mean, come on. You know, I mean,
what, in your view, what are the best documentaries dealing with Auschwitz? I know there's quite a few out there.
Well, there's one that's out there. I don't know what it's called exactly. It's about a 49-minute one. It's called what's it called? Is it the Auschwitz? The big lie? Maybe no, it's not that.
I'll find it. I know there's one that I've watched that I actually found on the Barnes Reviews website.
Yeah. And well, there's one that shows some really good animation showing you people what it would look like in the room they claim was gas chambers in Auschwitz II, Birkenau. But anyway, that's probably one of the best ones. It's 49 minutes. I'm trying to think what it's called. If you just did a search, for it, Auschwitz, Auschwitz lies or something like that, you'd probably come. It's like about 50 minutes, And, you know, it's still up there as far as I understand. But anyway, there's other good ones too. One Third the Holocaust.
That's a good one. That one deals with the camps in the East, the camps in like Poland and Lithuania.
Yes.
And now were all those camps in the East? They were all, they were all taken over by the Soviets, correct? Too, the Americans really didn't have anything to do with those camps.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now talk about those camps, because I know Eric Hunt has done a lot of work on this just recently, you know, with Sobibor and some of these other camps.
Yeah.
And basically, they were just. They claim that there was millions of people killed, at least 1 million people killed there, I think, and they buried the bodies, and then they dug them up and reburied them and burned them.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it goes on and on. It's like just one gigantic horror story, and none of it is true. There's no evidence for any of it.
Yeah, well, he did the video, the Treblinka hoax, exposing Caroline...
I forgot
her last name.
The British
yeah.
Jew. I think she's Jewish as well.
Yeah. But anyway... He kind of blows her out of the water, and he talks about Treblinka, and I think Medanik in that also, in that video. But the Treblinka one, yeah. I mean, here's Treblinka. I mean, you know, it's like several acres. There was Treblinka 1, Treblinka 2. And I believe it was Treblinka 2 they said the people were going in there being killed immediately, which, you know, again, you have to show, you know, if they say 850,000 people died in this camp, fine. Where's the evidence of it? Where are the bodies buried? Think about it. 800,000 people. I mean, even if they crushed all the bones, I mean, you have teeth. Teeth don't get crushed. I mean, there's got to be a lot of teeth somewhere. I mean, you know.
And there's nothing. Yeah, there's absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing there. So, you know, they're just throwing this at you, saying, oh, this is what happened here. And like you were saying, theirs get even more bizarre, because they say the people were gassed. Not with Zyklon B gas, but they said that they were killed with carbon diesel gas. Okay, so
right.
Carbon monoxide.
And this is where the gas vans come in. This was being used there allegedly.
Yeah,
where they were, it was vehicles.
Well, they said they had a diesel motor from a Russian submarine that they were using to produce the diesel gas.
And weren't they? Yeah, weren't they claiming that they were locking people in vans and pumping this gas?
Well,
that's
another story too. The van controversy, which is a bunch of baloney too. You can't kill people with carbon monoxide. Diesel. You can't kill people with diesel. You can kill them with carbon monoxide, but not diesel, because it doesn't produce enough carbon monoxide. Mm. Diesel has too much oxygen in it. So I mean, they might get sick or whatever. Remember, they used the diesel engines down in mines, you know, when they're digging, you know, big things under the ground, you know, tunnels and stuff. They use diesel engines there all the time, and they don't have any issue. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Diesel will not kill you. Now, if they just went by the original story, what they should have done is just said they were killed with plain old gasoline engines, that would have made more sense. But they didn't in the beginning.
Yeah.
Said it was diesel. Of course, they've changed it now to say it was a gasoline engine, you know, and that's how they did it. But that's only one of the ways they say they were killed. They said they were electrocuted, drowned. I mean, they had you name any crazy way you can kill somebody, you know, atom bombs, little atom bombs, blew them all up and stuff. I mean, stupidest thing. I mean, read the stuff; it's just insane.
Yeah.
So Treblinka. See, I don't deal with Treblinka because Treblinka is so off the wall. Okay. Because that's not where they take you on the tour anyway. They take you on the tour in Auschwitz I. I mean, that's the main one that they deal with today.
Well, I mean, you can go up to Treblinka. There are museums there as well.
Oh, no, I know that. But that's, you know, even
that's
though...
Not that's not one of the main ones. The Auschwitz is like the iconic, you know, sort of defines the Holocaust,
Yeah, that's the main, that's the main Disneyland for them. And that's where they make all their money. But, you know, you can go to the other ones too, but there's nothing there because they... They blew up all the buildings.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all reconstructions, from what I understand.
Well, right, but there's really nothing. There's nothing there in Birkenau. See, there's three Auschwitz camps. There's Auschwitz I, there's Birkenau, and there's Monowitz. Monowitz is where they worked in the factories producing where they were trying to produce synthetic rubber and synthetic oil, synthetic things, you know, and all that type of stuff. It was a big, huge IBG Fabin company, but. Anyway, that was Monowitz. So, Birkenau was where they said the majority of the people were killed. Okay, that's where they say, you know, a million people were killed or whatever in Birkenau, you know, in Crema 2 and 3 and then 4 and 5. But, you know, they've been all blown up. There's nothing there to show them there anymore. And that's a good question. Why were they blown up? You know, some people think the Germans blew them up. I don't personally believe the Germans blew them up. That's my opinion. But, you know, I think the Soviets blew them up because they didn't want to. Well, they probably did. They couldn't prove what they were trying to prove.
Yeah.
So just get rid of the evidence. That's my opinion. But, you know, everybody's going to have their own opinion on what happened. Yeah. But there's nothing there. That's the point.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the camps and what they were like, because, you know, this always comes up. People have seen these truly horrific photos of these, like, emaciated prisoners, and they think that, you know, they were severely mistreated in these camps, and they were beaten and starved and worked to death. And really, none of that is true. So could you talk about the nature of these camps? What were they like? What was their purpose? Yeah.
Right, okay. Basically, there were a couple different types of camps. They did have concentration camps, you know, and the people in those camps were Soviets.
These are basically, when you say concentration camp, they're basically detention centers.
Prisons,
right.
Yeah, they would be considered
communists, Jews.
Yeah, could be. Well, no, there could be a lot of Jews if they were Soviets.
Yeah, exactly.
No. So they had concentration camps. That's where Rosner was. He was in Birkenau. I mean, not Birkenau, Buchenwald, I believe. In Dora, which basically was a prison camp for these treasonous, you know, people, these Soviet people, and that's where they were. Okay, you know, and they were re-education camps, you know, to try to get some of these people back on track. And of course, if some of them didn't want to, you know, do what was right here and learn what the nationalist way of life here. They probably could have been killed or shot or whatever. And the Germans had a perfect right to do it. I mean, you can do whatever you want with prisoners of war. I mean, that's what happens. I mean, that's what they were.
Well, and even these people, it's not as if they were being mistreated and murdered and, you know, beaten up and stuff like that. I mean,
well,
it was...
but see, John, here's the thing. Even if they were.
So what? Yeah, right.
So it's, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Because in our country, it happens all the time.
Right.
We have our prisons here, and we have people in prison, and they're beaten up, and they're hurt, and that's the way it is. I don't agree with it. It's not something, you know, right. But again, whatever the reasoning is and whatever happened to these prisoners, that's an issue. The other camps now, let's just deal with those. The work camps. The camps where the general population of people went into, and the Jews, you know, went into, they were work camps where they had to work and provide labor for the German war machine. That's why they were there. I mean, think about it. They had to take these people out of the ghettos, and they had to do something with them. I mean, if you were going to kill them, just burn them in the ghettos.
Or just shoot them. Yeah, shoot them. Or
shoot them or burn them. I mean, that would have been a simple thing. But to think that you're going to transport thousands or millions of people all the way to Auschwitz and Treblinka and all these camps to kill them, that's a tremendous waste of time and money and all these things. You know what I mean?
Well, it is. It's a waste of resources, a waste of time, as you said. But also, it's truly logistically impossible to do this.
Impossible.
To kill, I mean, 6 million people in a matter of, what, 2 years? I mean, it's just not possible. And especially the way they said that these people were murdered. Right. It's just, it's impossible. And really, I think what needs to be understood is that the Germans, I mean, their policy was most certainly to rid Germany of its Jewish population. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
That's what they were all about. They were trying to get rid of the Jews and get them out of Germany. They implemented laws that basically disenfranchised Jews and prevented them from teaching and serving in government and, you know, many other things. And they encouraged the Jewish population to leave on their own, and many of them did.
Right.
Some of them that didn't, as you mentioned, you know, they were in these ghettos where they were basically you know, sort of secluded and isolated until they could be deported out of Germany.
Right.
And when they went to these camps, they had a network of these camps all across Germany, all across Eastern Europe, pretty much, you know, everywhere the Germans went, they built these camps to supply the war effort, to transport troops, to transport, you know, these prisoners, these aliens that were frankly being deported for good reason.
Right.
And you know, these camps were transit camps. They were ways in which, and I mean, think about it. Like, for example, Auschwitz, it was a huge industrial center. I mean, there was all sorts of factories. There were barracks. There were schools, there were hospitals. I mean, they were like little cities almost.
Oh, sure.
Think of a modern military base.
Oh,
it was the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You had everything in these camps, a small city, well, a good-sized city, actually, would have, and they had it. So basically, the Jews, they, and here's another thing that people don't understand. There weren't as many Jews as you think in those camps. The majority of the Jews left by the time the war even got cooking. Because they were, you know, they were invited to leave.
Okay? Exactly.
And now, so a lot of them left.
But and isn't a good estimate? I mean, even according to the International Red Cross, didn't they even write that only it was like 270,000 total people died in the various camps administered by the Germans?
Yeah,
so 270,000 total people died. Yeah. Many of them weren't even Jewish. And these people died as a result of a variety of illnesses and sicknesses. Yeah. It wasn't as if the Germans were systematically murdering these people. Far from it.
Right.
And this is another thing I wanted to bring up is official German policy was to maintain the health of these people and to ensure that they were not mistreated. And German soldiers and officials that did mistreat these prisoners were punished.
Right.
So
yeah,
they were doing everything. Yeah. Yeah, they were doing everything in their power to provide for these people, so they could provide, you know, the valuable labor for the war effort, and you know the quote unquote gas chambers. There were gas chambers, but they were used to delouse clothes, to delouse clothing and you know bed sheets and whatnot to kill these bugs that were spreading typhus and other diseases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it. You're right, and a lot of people. Here's the thing. You asked the question in the beginning, like how could you, you know, because people are going to say to you, oh, look at this picture of it shows a bulldozer bulldozing all these bodies into a grave. Of course, that bulldozer one was Bergen-Belsen, which, you know, what people don't understand is this. The pictures they are showing you are pictures taken in the last weeks or month of the war. And all those people and all those bodies that died because of the result of starvation, sickness, and disease brought upon by the Allies who bombed all the railroads and bombed all the rail lines and the roads. They couldn't get supplies in. They couldn't get food in. And think about it. If you don't have food for a month, you're going to be dead.
Yeah.
Okay? So these people were dropping like flies, and those are the pictures you see. You don't see any bodies or piles of body in Auschwitz because – you know, even though I'm sure the people died, there weren't huge amounts of bodies because, you know, unless the people died in the last week or two, three of the war.
In Buchenwald, I mean, and this is something I've written about on my website in the past, Buchenwald, you know, the U.S. Army shows up, the British, what would it be, the Imperial Army? I don't even know. The British Army, basically. They both show up at Buchenwald, and they have, you know, people that specialize in psychological warfare and people from Hollywood to film all this.
Yeah,
and they were using this footage to, you know, demonize the Germans. Oh, look at what these evil Germans did to these people. Right. None of it's put in proper context.
Right.
It's all heavily distorted. Some of the photographs that these people took are you know, literally fabricated. They're fake photographs.
Sure. Yeah, or they could be dead Germans.
Right, or that's the thing. It's like they're never put in context. Nothing is ever properly explained as to why these people are dead.
Right.
And from what I understand, one of the water treatment plants right outside Buchenwald was damaged in these Allied bomb raids. So their water supply got contaminated, which is why many people got sick there.
Right, yeah. I mean, they had issues. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
But again, the people – see, here's what you got to say to someone that looks at those pictures and think you're crazy because you don't believe the Holocaust happened. You say to them, are you a forensic expert? And they're going to say, what do you mean? Well, do you know how that body you're looking at died? How did they die? Can you tell forensically a body on the ground how it died? See, they're not going to have an answer for you. Because, again, if you see a person that's all skin and bones – I mean skin and bones. I mean really – how would you assume he died? Was he put in a gas? You think that person walked into a gas chamber?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, they died of starvation or sickness. You know what I'm saying? And those are the bodies that you're seeing. You never, ever, ever see full-figured bodies of people that were supposedly killed in gas chambers.
Mm-hmm.
Never, because it never happened. Okay? Remember, they claimed that they were bringing trainloads of people, and the women and children went right into the right into the gas chambers right when they got there.
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, show me a full figured body. I mean, if you claim 6 million people died, there's gotta be one picture of somebody that was gassed in one of these gas chambers that is a full figured person.
Yeah.
You know, not skin and bones. Again, all the pictures they show are skin and bones, because those are the people that died at the end of the war. And also, the Americans and the English, at the end of the war, they made a real error. Because when they went into these camps, they fed the people a diet that actually killed them.
Okay? That's right, yeah.
They gave them a real high, rich, fatty diet. Okay, they thought this is what
and their bodies couldn't handle it, right?
They couldn't handle. Thousands of them died within the week.
Right.
Okay, and these are the pictures you're seeing. Those are the pictures they're showing you of the people that died who were fed, fed. I actually put a video up last week about that called "Died by a Meal" or "Death by a Meal" on YouTube, and it's the part of the video that goes to the fellow that did One Third the Holocaust video, Denia Bud guy.
Right.
He did that big long one. And one part of that video had a 10 minute clip about those who were in the camps that were killed by being fed the wrong food.
Yes. Interesting aspect of the Holocaust that a lot of people don't know about. So, just to kind of summarize, in your view, the best way to deal with the Holocaust when you're talking to, just average people, is just to try to keep it as simple as possible, make a few basic points, focus on Auschwitz,
ask them what they know. When you deal with somebody,
and most people don't know anything. They really don't know anything.
So you want to find out what they know, and then just question what they know. Just say, well, what do you know about it? Blah, 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 blah. Well, how do you know? Can you tell a person how they died by looking at them? You should be a forensic expert. I mean, come on.
Yeah. The vast majority of people literally know nothing at all about the Holocaust, other than 6 million people died and Hitler was evil.
Yeah, that's
it. But they don't even know why they believe that. They can't even really explain to you how they know that these things happened. They just, it's just, again, it's just this myth, a myth that
that's why the first book they should read is The Myth of German Villainy. In fact, if you have a spot on your website, you might want to put that up there. The Myth of German Villainy. When people read that simple book, they're going to see the whole story from day one, from Germany's perspective, what happened, what really happened. And then they can put it all together, because he talks about the Holocaust pretty extensively in that too.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do that. I need to read it and like write a review of it. That'd be a good thing to do.
Yeah. Well, he's been interviewed,
Yeah. I heard him on Rents. He was also interviewed by, what's her name? Erin Dakins.
Okay.
From Truth Traveler.
In fact, she's the one that told me about it.
Erin
Dakins, right, Diane? She's the one that gave us this telephone number.
She's another really awesome woman, yeah.
Yeah, she was good for that. But, you got to get the simplest way to deal with this topic. Don't get too technical with it.
Yeah.
Just deal with the simplest things.
Tell me what you think. This is how I try to deal with it. There's three basic points that I make. Number one, there was no German policy to exterminate Jews, this is admitted by mainstream historians, Jewish historians. There's no documents, there's no official order from Hitler or any other National Socialist leader that outlines a policy to systematically murder Jews.
Right.
Number two, the German policy in regards to the Jews was to rid them, to get them out of Germany, was to ethnically cleanse Germany of its Jewish population. There's no doubt about that. And that, people may consider that harsh or extreme or whatever, but that is what their policy was. They wanted to get the Jews out of Germany. They recognized the Jews as hostile to the German nation, as an alien, parasitic, foreign nation residing, in Germany, exploiting Germany, and really subverting its culture and subverting its government and everything else. So they recognized these people as a threat. Openly talked about this, openly wrote about this, and made moves to get the Jews out of Germany as peacefully as possible. They facilitated this. They mm-hmm. sent them to these labor camps where they were providing labor until they could figure out, you know, what to do with them. Yeah. So that was the official German policy, was to ethnically cleanse Germany of its Jewish population.
Right.
And then the third point I make is that the concentration camps, or the quote-unquote death camps, were in reality work camps and detention
right.
centers. That's all they were. They were not death camps, and we can prove this.
Right.
So these are the main points I make, and I, of course, I can elaborate on all of them.
Right.
But really, I think these are the main ones that I always try to bring up. And
sure.
then I always point this out, because this is very interesting. And again, it just underscores the totally backwards nature of the official narrative of the Holocaust. As I mentioned, the first point I always make is that there's no German policy to genocide the Jews, to murder Jews at all. That there's just nothing there. And this is admitted by mainstream historians. However, prior to and during World War II, Jewish intellectuals and propagandists in America, in the UK, in the Soviet Union were openly declaring their desire to destroy Germany and to destroy the German nation.
Right.
We have countless examples of this. Theodor Kaufmann comes to mind. He wrote the book Germany Must Perish, where he is literally openly declaring that he wants to see the United States and the Allies genocide the German people, you know, turn them into a backwards country. This was official American policy.
Right.
Henry Morgenthau wanted mm-hmm. to totally decimate Germany, turn it into this like backwards agricultural society, totally deindustrialize it. You know, basically murder and imprison all of the top National Socialist officials, which they did. So we can prove that the real genocide actually happened to Germany,
right.
not to the Jews. And
mm-hmm.
that is such a powerful point that really needs to be recognized and understood.
Right. Yeah, that's it. I mean, simple and sweet. I mean, you know, you kind of summed it all up there. And, you know, once people understand that the bad guys were the Americans and the Allies. Those were the real bad guys. And the Holocaust was just an incidental thing to cover up the evil doings on of the Allies and Americans, who were bombing the hell out of Germany, killing innocent people, burning their cities down to nothing. Innocent people. That's what they did. That's what the United
right.
States did. Okay?
Exactly.
The Germans didn't, you didn't see the Germans do anything like that. They actually, if anything, they saved the Jews. Because the Jews were in a camp where they, you know, a lot of them survived. If they weren't in those camps, they wouldn't have survived.
Right. Again, another irony, that the Jews were safer in these
right.
German concentration camps
right.
rather than, you know, being out, you know, in a city or something. Because,
right.
Again, the point you're making is spot on. The Allies were the ones that committed the
sure.
true war crimes. It was not the Germans.
Yeah. Right, right.
And,
yeah.
I mean, Germany's just been so demonized. And, again, it goes back to World War One, and probably even before that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about what they were saying in World War One, that German soldiers were throwing Belgian babies up
right.
and bayoneting them. I mean, how
yeah.
ridiculous is
yeah.
this?
And the gas story, the gas chamber thing was just borrowed from that, too. They said they had gas chambers and everything
back
else.
During World War One.
Oh, sure, yeah.
yeah.
Everything, there's nothing that changed. It's
yeah.
just the time.
Yeah.
You know, the same old baloney came from World War One. They said the Germans were doing there, you know, because they had to make the Germans look like they were evil people during World War One, so they get the United States to come in on the war.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's what had to happen there.
Well, and of course, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the legendary 6 million figure that's been floating about, or it's been floated about since like the late 1800s, I believe.
Yeah.
Where these Jewish public relations experts, basically, were, you know, writing op-eds and writing appeals in various newspapers in America and in the West, saying that 6 million Jews were being persecuted in Russia and in Poland and in Romania and in Germany and you name it. And, you know, we had to give them all our money to get them to come to America and
right.
settle here. So it was just a big scam. It was
yeah.
it was a scam then, and it's a scam today.
Yeah, it was all set up. It was all set up. And once they had everything going, then everything just fell into place. And then, you know, again, the lies started coming in to, you know, the show, all the stuff they said happened that didn't happen. And again, take the heat off the United States, take the heat off England and France.
Yes.
For all the bad things that they did to the Germans. Pretty simple. It's not a complicated thing, but, you know, and also too, there weren't that many Jews. Remember, at the most, there might have been 4 million Jews in all of the occupied area where Germany, you know, they cared for. Okay, and let's 4 million of them. I mean, really, how many people survived to collect reparations? There's over 4 million.
I know it's
who,
absurd.
Who died? I mean, come
talk,
on.
I mean, really, again, talk about just a total scam, man. Just like the biggest. The biggest racket, the biggest scam
ever. Actually, you know
what
it is, John? It's the biggest insurance scam.
Yes.
Because, see, the reparation market had to be based on the numbers of people they said were involved in it so they can collect the money. You couldn't just have 5,000. You had to have millions of people so that you could get billions of dollars. So the more they could add to that pot of survivors and people who were supposedly harmed, then that's how they did it. It was a big insurance scam. And it continues to scam today because they want to come after France now for money too because they said they were involved too. But anyway, that's all it is. It's the biggest insurance scam. You have people that are in there two or three times as reparation collectors. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ridiculous how bad this is. And people, you know, no one's going to question it. Everybody's just going to give in to what they say, you know. It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, man. Well, I wanted to kind of we've kind of addressed this question, but I wanted to focus a little bit more on it before we wrap up. Why do you think it's so difficult for people to deal rationally and critically with this alleged Holocaust narrative?
Well, because there's a lot of money involved. It's all money. It all comes down to money, and it's a cult. Okay, the whole Holocaust is based on it's a cult mentality. Of thinking, okay? So now you're dealing with a whole different prospect here, a whole different aspect of it, okay? You're dealing with a religious view of something. This is a religious belief of Jews, okay? It goes right into the religious beliefs of the Jews, and it's a cult thinking. So it's very hard for these people, when you present to them another side of the story, or anybody even who is sympathetic with them, to see the other side, because it's like somebody being in a cult and then trying to show them they're in a cult.
Yeah.
It's impossible. True, yeah. It's almost impossible to do that. Very few people can just, you know, it's like you're in the fishbowl. It's either you're in it or you're out. Mm-hmm. If you're out, you can see what's going on in it. These people are in the fishbowl. It's hard for them to see outside the fishbowl.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I've noticed is when I talk to just average people about the Holocaust, they always bring up the photographs and the video footage and of course these alleged Holocaust survivors. And in my view, the propaganda associated with the Holocaust, the propaganda associated with instilling and perpetuating this fake story is really a form of psychological warfare. It's very emotionally exploitative and traumatizing. And, you know, we talked about how many, really psychological warfare specialists in the U.S. Army and in the British Army were involved in capturing this footage and manipulating this footage and using it to demonize the Germans and instill this fake Holocaust story. So we've seen, I mean, this is really scientifically and professionally done.
Oh, sure. Yeah. 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 It didn't just happen. Believe me.
Yeah.
They sat down and they planned this all out. How they were going to make this all come about, and they had every piece in order, and then you get the Nuremberg trials. We didn't even get into the Nuremberg trials.
That was
Holy
exactly
mackerel.
What I wanted to get into next.
Well, the Nuremberg trials, okay, that's all it was a Soviet show trial, okay? All the people, okay, there was about 22 people of Nazis that were brought up at the Nuremberg trials, okay? Half of them were killed, all right? But think about this. What they did with these guys is they came in with saying that the Holocaust is true. 6 million Jews died and they were killed in gas chambers. That was the story that was accepted and presented in the court. The court made a ruling on it saying this is what happened. Any deviation from this is not going to be accepted. Okay. So now here's the men, you know, going up in the trials, the Nuremberg trials. And they didn't even meet with their lawyers. They couldn't even meet with their lawyers to tell the other side of the story. And also, they had to actually, a lot of them had to lie to protect their asses or thinking they were protecting their asses because they would say somebody else was involved with it, doing these horrible feats and killing people, not them. they weren't doing this, but other people were doing this and killing and gassing these people. See, they had to admit that the people were being gassed and killed, because if they didn't do that, they were told they would be executed and killed. Their family wouldn't get their pensions, or, you know, they threatened all these people. I mean, you know, this is what they did. So basically, it was people that had to lie, thinking they were protecting their lives, and some of them did protect themselves. They got other people to take the hit, but, you know, half of them were killed. And think about this: what trial do you know that someone gets a death sentence and they don't have an appeal?
Yeah.
I mean, yep. These people were killed.
It was a show trial, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they were killed immediately. And the reason why they were killed so quick was because they had to get rid of the evidence. And they were the evidence. Mm-hmm. Okay? If they ever talked after, it would have just exposed the whole scam. Mm-hmm. But so they had to kill these people as quick as possible. And that's what they did.
Weren't many of the prosecutors and interrogators and the lawyers involved in this trial and in all of the post-war trials, weren't most of them Jewish too?
Yeah, yeah. They were either Jewish or Jewish influence. A lot of the judges, you know, a few, two or three of them, or four or thereabouts, were Jews. Not all of them, but, you know, in any judge who saw what was going on would, I think, I forgot who he was, but one of them left. You know, he left the trial because he said, this is just a sham, you know, what's going on here. So, yeah, the influence of the Jews in the trials was ridiculous. I mean, you know, they were the ones that were bringing all this upon them, and there was no way that these men were going to be found innocent. And even though a couple did probably get life sentences or long sentences, but half of them, you know, were executed immediately. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of testimony, like Hoss, you know, everybody goes by Hoss's testimony, you know, saying, yeah, they had gas chambers here, and 2.5 million people were put in these gas chambers. I mean, they know he was tortured. The guy was tortured, you know. You know, it's interesting. You might want to look up this guy, the guy who took over Auschwitz after Hoss did. Okay, Hoss left Auschwitz, I think, in 1941, early. And another fellow, you know, took over. His name was Richard Baer, B-A-E-R. Do you know what happened to him? He was supposed to testify at the Auschwitz trials in the 60s, I believe it was. And what happened was he mysteriously died.
Oh, imagine that.
Well, the reason is because he said nothing happened in the camp.
Yeah.
Okay, there was no homicidal gas chambers. They weren't killing people in the camps. Mm-hmm. And so now here he is, you know, one of the, you know, the camp commandants who survived. And they had to get rid of him quick. So before the Auschwitz trials even started, he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
He was gone.
The whole scenario was just an absolute joke. I mean, it really was a show trial, as you said. That is the best way to describe it. It was a genocidal show trial. They wanted to murder all these top German officials.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and they did.
And they pretty much did, yeah.
Yeah, they got rid of him. And the ones that they wanted to save. Now, think about this. Who was the worst person in Auschwitz that people talk about today? It was Mengele.
Mengele, yeah.
And guess where Mengele ended up? He ended up in England. He was in England for like 10 years.
Oh, wow. See, I don't know much about Mengele. I know there's all these stories about him.
Well, no, but think about it. He was supposed to be the worst of the worst. They should have shot him right there. Okay?
Yeah, true.
But he ends up, the British end up bringing him to England, protecting him. And then he went to Argentina, I believe. But, can you imagine the worst of the worst that everybody said he was killing everybody and doing experiments on and blah, blah, blah. And he ends up in England working for them. Unbelievable,
yeah.
You know, unbelievable.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, there's basically one final topic I kind of wanted to wrap up on, and then, you know, we can conclude this discussion. I wanted to talk about how the Holocaust narrative is really being used as a weapon to demonize and undermine Western civilization generally, but really white racial solidarity and white racial consciousness. You know, anybody who considers themselves white and recognizes the importance of the white race and cares about the future of the white race is immediately demonized as a Nazi, and right. You know, they want to murder 6 million Jews. So it's used really to demonize white people and to use as a weapon against white people. On the other hand, the fake narrative is used to strengthen Jewish identity and strengthen, right, you know, the purpose of the Jewish community, not only, you know, financially, but also from a cultural perspective. You know, it's really an asset of the organized Jewish community, and it's used as a weapon against white people. Do you have any comments on that?
Oh, no, that's absolutely it. I mean, anybody that talks about the Holocaust in the true sense of what really happened, they're going to be, first of all, going to be, I mean, figure this one out. You're going to be called racist. Now, I don't know how that comes into play, but you're a racist hater, okay? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you want to see everybody killed in the world, I guess. What does it have to do with race? This has nothing to do with race, but the Jews think they are a race, okay? They think they are a powerful race of people that have a special calling from God. I mean, come on, you know? So anybody that criticizes them, that says anything that's truthful against them, I mean, they're going to be demonized. So you're right. But basically, it's like the white people are the ones, you know, because mostly the white people are the ones speaking out against it. They're the ones that now are demonized as being haters and, you know, wants to kill everybody in the world, especially all the other races.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it is totally being used as a weapon to really demonize the entire Western world. And there are many examples of Jews openly saying this. I wrote a blog post back in April of 2015, which I'll link to when I post this program. And I titled it, Top Jewish Leader Claims Entire Western World Culpable for the Holocaust.
Right.
And it was Ronald Lauder of the World Jewish Congress, and he was giving a speech. I think it was the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Bergen-Belsen.
Right.
And he basically said, look, the entire Western world is responsible for the Holocaust.
Sure.
The West didn't do enough to save us poor Jews.
Yeah.
So he's basically demonizing the entire white Western world. And there's also this comment, oh my gosh, this is just outrageous. I'm not sure if you've came across this yet. It was a Jewish man named Ian Kagedan, and he was the former national director of government relations of B'nai B'rith up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote in 1991 in a Toronto Star op-ed piece, it was titled, Memory of the Holocaust Central to New World Order. What an amazing title for an op-ed.
Right.
Again, Memory of the Holocaust Central to New World Order. Think about what that means, guys.
Yeah.
So he says here, the Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure.
Right.
It was a natural outcome of centuries of racism and of anti-Semitism. To deny the Holocaust is to deny racism's capacity to undercut our civilization's basic values and to destroy democracy. Achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning the Holocaust's lessons.
Right.
What an incredibly revealing quote here.
Mm-hmm.
The Holocaust is the key to the entire New World Order. It is the key that, you know, the key weapon that demonizes white people, that prevents us from having any sort of racial consciousness. Heaven forbid we do that. We'd be Nazis who want to kill 6 million Jews. It is a psychological weapon of war.
Right. Yeah, it's all about them.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Exactly. And I mean, there's Jewish historians that have argued that the fake Holocaust narrative is actually central to Jewish power.
Yeah.
And you know, in America and throughout the wider Western world, it's just incredible what they themselves openly admit about this weaponized narrative of history that they have concocted and manufactured and perpetuated and reinstilled in so many different ways, but largely through the media and through their control over you know, entertainment and our educational establishment. It's just a total outrage what they're doing and what they're saying and how they're using it to demonize us and to collect all this money. It's just, oh my gosh, it's got to stop. We got to put an end to this madness.
Well, little by little, but you know, again, without the Holocaust, the Jews would be nothing.
It's true.
Nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing.
It's a key aspect of Jewish power, a key aspect of Jewish identity. I mean, you know, in some of these public opinion polls, they ask Jews what is the most central aspect of their Jewish identity, and they talk about the Holocaust.
Right, right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
So, okay. Well, Jim, this was a really good conversation. We covered a lot of ground, and I want to thank you so much for joining me today. We'll have to do it again.
Yep. I want to make just one. Can I make one comment?
Yeah, please.
I want to just say that, you know, the question that comes up now is, what can I do? Well, what I'm trying to do with people is I'm trying to get people in their own towns to get on their own cable stations because you can produce cable shows that have this information in it. And I would be happy to produce the show and present it to them, and they can present it to their cable stations. And if everybody we can get to do this, then you'd have this information on TV, and they can't stop you. I mean, they're going to try, and they might even, but, you know, we have an opportunity and ability to use our cable stations in each town. Each town has cable station, usually, and you can produce cable ready information dealing with any topic, whatever you want to think about, on the TV. It just has to be, you know, put together in an edited form so they can accept it. And I think that what we have to do is we got to get more people out there aware, you know, even though they might not be video people, they might not do what I do, I can do it for them. I can give them a video of the topics because I have tons and tons of stuff and make it for them to present on their cable station. I mean, that's what we can do. I'm just saying.
Gosh, that's what I this is something else that I should be doing, man. We'll have to talk about this.
Yeah, right. I'm just saying.
I'd love to do it myself.
I mean, you really want to shake them up. You have the ability right now, okay, to be on TV doing what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. I mean, you can be, you know, talking to people, interviewing people. You can bring video in that all these things we're talking about. I mean, we can do it. You understand?
Yeah.
We can do it.
Okay. Yeah, very good. We'll definitely have to talk about that here soon.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Jim. I really appreciate it. I will, of course, have links over to your main website and to the YouTube channel for the League of Extraordinary Revisionists. Be sure to check out those interviews you've conducted with some of these legendary figures. I mean, my gosh, these are some of the greatest heroes this movement that you've interviewed.
Now is the time.
Keep up the good work. Tell Diane I said hello, and I'll be talking to you guys soon.
All right, John, thank you. Great,
thank you. All right, thanks everybody for tuning in.
Inside your history books, and turn to the pages that covers World War II, and focus your attention on the 6 million Jews. Yes, 6 million Jews, it's a mantra you see. Not my point of view, but a fact, so don't get mad at me. There were no gas chambers in any of the labor camps. The victors wrote the story, it needs to be revamped. You see, the Holocaust is not what it appears to be. Yes, the Holocaust needs to be looked at more carefully. Yes, the Holocaust, clearly a logistic impossibility. Yes, the Holocaust, a cash cow that keeps making money. 6 million lies is what we are told at birth. 6 million lies, it keeps growing and only gets worse. They used it as a propaganda tool for Zionist Israel, while forcing Palestine to become a living hell. You see, the Holocaust is not what it appears to be. Yes, the Holocaust needs to be looked at more carefully. Yes, the Holocaust, clearly a logistic impossibility. Yes, the cash cow that keeps making money. Six million lies. 6 million, 6 million, 6 million did not die. It's a mantra repeated over and over. It's time to end this now. You see, the Holocaust is not what it appears to be.